Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, the Doctrine of Creation, Part 8. For more resources from Dr. Craig, go to reasonablefaith.org.
We've been talking in our class, dealing with Doctrine of Creation, on creatio continuans, continuing creation. And you remember I said that the doctrine of creatio continuans, or continuing creation, had two sub-areas. One was conservatio, or conservation of the world in being, God's preserving the world and everything in it from one moment to the next. And then the other area is called concursus, or concurrence in English. And we have now completed our discussion of the doctrine of conservation, and so we want to say a word about the doctrine of concurrence. According to the doctrine of concurrence, God is literally the cause of everything that happens in the world. Now, this is not to say that God is the only cause of everything that happens. That is a doctrine which is called occasionalism, which was held to by certain medieval Muslim theologians who said that, in fact, there are no secondary causes operative in the world. God is the only cause of anything that happens, and he merely acts on certain occasions to bring about effects. So, for example, on the occasion of the match being brought into proximity with the gasoline, God causes the gasoline to ignite and explode. The match doesn't cause it. The match has no causal, or the flame has no causal power to do anything. It is merely the occasion upon which God causes things. That's the doctrine of occasionalism, which says that God is the only cause there is. The doctrine of concurrence is not the doctrine that God is the only cause of everything that happens. Rather, it is the doctrine that God concurs with the operation of secondary causes in the world. And in the absence of God's concurring with them, nothing would be caused by these secondary effects. Nothing would be produced by them. So, everything that happens in the world, in a sense, has two causes. One is the secondary causes that produce things about us that we see. The other would be God as the primary cause who brings about or concurs with the operation of secondary causes to produce their effects. Now, this remarkable doctrine is almost totally neglected in contemporary theology and discussions of God's relationship to the world. You never hear anyone today virtually affirming or talking about the doctrine of divine concurrence. And yet, if you reflect upon the doctrine of conservation, it seems that the doctrine of concurrence follows logically from the doctrine of conservation. And as I said last week, the doctrine of conservation is pretty much the only doctrine of creation that most contemporary theologians hold to. They have abandoned largely creatio originans, the originating creation, and simply hold to conservation of the world in being by God. And yet, if you have a serious doctrine of conservation, it seems that concurrence follows logically from it. Think about it. If God conserves some event E from time T to a later time, T prime, so that God conserves E in being from T to T prime, then he must conserve E, not just in abstraction, but he has to conserve E with all its particularity, with all its particular properties that it has at those moments. So let's suppose that at time t, E is, say, a fluffy ball of, of white cotton, which is brought into proximity with a match, with a flame. And let's suppose that as a result of that, by T prime, the cotton becomes black and smoldering is no longer fluffy white. Now, if God preserves the cotton in being from T to T prime, he doesn't just preserve the cotton in a sort of abstract sense, he preserves it in all of its particularity. Its whiteness and fluffiness at T, it's being black and smoldering at T prime. And in order for the cotton to exist in all its particularity with its particular properties, God must bring about its existing at T with its properties at T, and he brings it about that it exists at T prime with those particular properties. And so conservation would seem to require that God is the cause of the cotton's being white and fluffy at T and being black and smoldering at T prime. Now, someone might try to escape this conclusion by saying, well, God wills that the cotton be white and fluffy at T, but he doesn't bring it about that the cotton is fluffy and white at T. But it seems to me that that would be incompatible with a doctrine of divine providence. Again, think about it. Either God wills that the cotton is fluffy and white at T or not. He either wills that it's white and fluffy at T or he doesn't will it. If he doesn't will that it's white and fluffy at T, and this is true of any event, then it means God is utterly indifferent to what happens in the world. He conserves it in being, but he doesn't have any will with respect to what happens in it. He doesn't care what happens in the world, and that would deny God's providence. So I don't think we can say that God is just indifferent to what happens at time T. Suppose then that God does will that the cotton is white and fluffy at time T. Well, in that case, his will is either directive or it's merely permissive. He either directly wills that the cotton be white and fluffy at T, or he merely permits it to be white and fluffy at T. But again, if his will is directive, if God wills that the cotton be white and fluffy at T, but he doesn't bring it about that it's white and fluffy at T, then God's will is impotent. It doesn't do anything. He wills that the cotton be that way, but it doesn't do it. It isn't that way as a result. So that if God's will is directive, it would follow that God is impotent, which is unacceptable. If you say, well, it's merely permissive, he merely permits the cotton to be white and fluffy at T, then again you seem to be denying God's providence, because God doesn't directly will anything to happen at that moment. He's indifferent. He just permits things to happen, but he doesn't have any directive will, which seems to deny divine providence. So it does seem that a robust doctrine of conservation of the world and being would imply a doctrine of concurrence. God not only wills that certain things exist and persevere or are conserved from time to time, but he wills that they exist with all of their particular properties at these various times, and therefore they do. And it was on the basis of this that classical theologians were able to explain certain miracles in the Bible. For example, in Daniel chapter 3, you have this well-known story of King Nebuchadnezzar casting three Israelites, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, into this fiery furnace to be burned alive. Let me read you a portion of the story from Daniel 3, verses 19 and following. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated seven times more than it was wont to be heated. And he ordered certain mighty men of his army, to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their mantles, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were cast into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was strict and the furnace very hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He said to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered the king, "True, O king." He answered, "But I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth man is like a son of the gods." So here, the flames are so intense, the heat so hot, that it completely roasts the guards that are throwing these three men into the fire. But then they are unharmed by the flames. They're walking around inside of this burning fiery furnace unharmed. And the way classical theologians explained this was by saying that God withdrew his concurring activity with the power of the flame. So that by not concurring with the causal effects of the flame, there was no effect produced on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and so they were unharmed. So it wasn't as though God covered them with some sort of invisible asbestos to protect them from the flames. No, he didn't concur with the secondary causes in this regard, and so that's how the men were unharmed. So this doctrine of divine concurrence was useful to them in explaining certain miracles that were found in the Bible on the basis of God's concurring activity, or in this case, his withdrawal of concurring activity. Any comments or questions that you have about this doctrine? Yes, Cindy, down here, Steve.
Are they saying then that the natural result of fire would be to consume the human body?
Right.
But that at that moment, God chose to prevent that from happening, which would be the normal course of events. So that he intervened into the natural process, such as having time stopped, and there's another point in Scripture where time literally stopped, or...
I don't think it's that, Cindy, if I understand your question. It's not as though God intervened to protect them by doing something. It's more that he just didn't concur
or allow
with the flames here so that the effect wasn't produced. In other words, everything that happens in the world according to the doctrine of concurrence has to be produced by secondary causes and by God. And if God doesn't concur with these secondary causes, they're impotent. And so the flames just had no power to produce any effects on these men.
So they're saying that this is not just the nature, that God created the fire and it has certain qualities, and but he's continually involved in their fulfilling their qualities.
Yes, that's right. Cindy is right here. This is a much more radical doctrine, I think you can see, than saying God gives secondary causes their causal powers. He gives to gasoline, say, the power of combustibility by giving it a certain chemical composition, or he gives to other things in the world solidity by virtue of the way they're composed. No, it's much more radical than that. It's that whenever any cause in the world operates, God has to concur by producing the effect along with the secondary cause, or nothing happens. This is a very strange doctrine. I mean, we're not used to hearing this, but that's the idea. So perhaps an example would be two men pulling a boat up onto the shore, each pulling by a different rope. You have here a sort of over-causation. Each man could pull the boat up by himself, but together they both cooperate in pulling the boat up to the shore. Well, that's sort of like concurrence, except that the doctrine of concurrence say unless God cooperates, then the other man, the other cause, has no power whatsoever to do anything. God has to concur in the operation of the other causes in order for these events to take place. Yeah, George back here has a comment.
Bill, I think I understand that this is different from the decree of God, like in the Westminster Confession, that everything that happens is decreed by God.
Yes,
but the effect seems to be the same, that God becomes causally involved in every event. Mm-hmm. And that is problematic, I think, when you have evil activity.
Yes.
And also, it seems to verge on pantheism. And why do we even need a doctrine of continuing creation?
Ah, all right. Now you're raising a very deep question there. Now, I don't think it's pantheism. Let's at least get that off the board. Here, God is causally distinct from the world. He conserves it in being. It's dependent upon him for its very existence, you know, moment by moment. If God were to withdraw his conserving activity, the world would be annihilated in a moment. And that's a good word to add to your vocabulary. The correlate of creation is not destruction, it's annihilation. And you see the word nihil in annihilate. To annihilate something would be to have it return to nothing. It would be just utterly annihilated. It would just completely cease to exist. So if God were to withdraw his conservation of the world in being, the world would just vanish. It wouldn't exist. So the doctrine of conservation is clearly anti-pantheistic in that the world is distinct from God and radically dependent upon him. And the question is, does concurrence follow from conservation? And I've given an argument for that that I find pretty persuasive to think that it does follow, which might then make you want to back up and say, well, wait a minute, in light of the unacceptable consequences for, say, the problem of evil, I'm going to go back and deny conservation, which is exactly what you said. And as I indicated last week, the biblical basis for conservation is not as strong, I think, as the biblical grounds for creation ex nihilo, originating creation. So that would be a view that would be contrary to normal Christian theology and doctrine. But as I say, I think conservation isn't as strongly attested biblically as creation out of nothing in the beginning. However, when we get to the topic of providence, which is the very next point on the outline, we'll talk about whether or not concurrence implicates God and evil. Concurrence has the very uncomfortable consequence that when the murderer plunges the knife into the victim and kills him, God causes the knife to plunge into the victim and kill him. That he concurs with the activity of the murderer. Otherwise, the knife wouldn't do anything. It wouldn't hurt anybody. So it does give you this uncomfortableness, as you say, with regard to sinful evil acts, that God is causing these to happen. But what the classical theologians would say is that God concurs in the action of the evil secondary agent in producing the effect the agent wants to do, but he doesn't agree with the agent's evil intentions and volitions to bring it about. So that God isn't morally responsible for murder. God doesn't will that thief murder its victim or his victim, and God doesn't cause the murderer to murder the victim, but he concurs with the activity of evil persons in order to allow them freedom of the will and permit them to do these bad things that they do. So they would maintain that concurrence just means that God will agree to produce the effect, but he doesn't agree with the motive or the intention that the evil person might have in bringing it about.
And I guess you're going to get to the point of whether you think this doctrine is necessary to a complete understanding of creation.
I'm not going to say anything more about that, George, okay, than I do, because I don't have very strong views on this one. It does seem to me that there's a good argument for it from conservation, and I'm very uncomfortable about giving up conservation in view of the history and the tradition behind that doctrine. So I would be more inclined personally to go along with the idea that God concurs in producing these effects, but he's not morally blameworthy or responsible for these effects because he doesn't will the intention or the evil that the secondary agents will in bringing these things about. He has to concur with the decisions of free agents and not nullify them if he's going to allow significant freedom in the world.
And just one more comment. It seems like it's hard to swallow that God is sustaining Hitler in existence as he kills the Jews.
I know.
And that, you know, I think is the same problem that Westminster Confession creates when it says God decrees everything that occurs, but God is not thereby the author of evil. That's hard to accept.
Well, see, that's the move I would want to make, though, George. And when we get to providence, I think that Molinism, with its doctrine of middle knowledge, will enable us to have a doctrine whereby we can say that God conserves the world in being, he is the cause of everything that happens, he concurs with these effects, and yet he isn't implicated by the evil that secondary agents do. Because it isn't a deterministic doctrine the way the Westminster Confession is and Calvinism is. So hang on to that point till the next item on the outline, which is providence, and see if the Molinist can offer a solution to this uncomfortable situation. Yes, Tom?
You sort of answered my question just now. One question I had, well, I couldn't quite tell how strongly you subscribe or agree with that, but you sort of just answered that.
Yeah, I think I did.
But the other question I had is, how does this play in the, say, the theory of evolution as it relates to random mutation? It seems like God would have to concur with random mutation. And
right.
Is there any kind of play in that whole
The doctrine
idea?
Of concurrence would say that God concurs with every effect right. that is produced by secondary causes in the world, including mutations. And they would be random. When biologists use the word random, this is very interesting in debates over evolutionary theory. They don't mean that it occurs without some sort of purpose, because they couldn't know whether or not there's a God who has allowed these mutations to occur for some purpose. What they mean is that the mutations occur without some sort of natural teleology, some natural goal for the benefit of the creature to which they're tending. They just happen. Irrespective of the survivability of the organism which mutates. So it's not what you think it is when they talk about random mutation. It isn't denying that there is some sort of overarching divine plan or supervision for this. It just means that these things happen without a view toward the benefit of the organism in which they're occurring. Yes, down here, Drew has a comment, I think.
How does this play out with the doctrine or the view of natural evil? Like, a good God could simply refrain, deny his concurrence for a hurricane that kills a bunch of people.
Right.
And this isn't preserving libertarian free will. This is just nature, theoretically, because God has concurrence. He could just fail to concur with all these horrendous disasters.
Yeah.
And still allow the world to work properly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. That God wills that the tsunami, or God concurs with the earthquake that produces the tsunami that sweeps across the island and kills all these people, and he concurs with the flame that burns people up or the hurricane or tornado that occurs. And it seems to me that anybody who believes in conservation of the world in being is going to have to say, yeah, God conserves the hurricane in being as it happens from one moment to the next. And you have to say, I think, and you, boy, this really leads beautifully into the next section on divine providence, is that you have to say that God has a plan for human history that includes these natural evils as well as moral evils, such that ultimately his overriding good purposes for the human race will be achieved through allowing these evils to occur. Bruce had a comment, I think.
Well, we do have a cursed world, but
sure.
I think you touched on it when you talked about purpose. I would overlay God's will, the various facets of God's will over this. I mean, you've got
absolutely.
God's absolute will is his purpose. He's going to accomplish that. He's got a permissive will that he allows people to do certain things. That's why you and I have purple maroon shirts on, and we step on the brake when people stop in front of us, and you have orange juice and like that, and God isn't concerned so much if I have orange juice, maybe how much of it. But that's permissive will. Then there's a prescriptive will. He's got commandments in the Bible we don't have to pray about that we're not supposed to do. And then he's right. got an emotive will. He's not willing that any should perish, but some do, because this is part of the interchange between free will, the plan for the absolute plan, and that you've given fallen man and fallen earth. So all these things come together. Even hurricanes produce beneficial effects by having oxygen carbon dioxide taken out of the atmosphere. So I would see these as
right.
operating.
What you have to do, if you're troubled with the notion of natural evil and God's concurring with these things, is go back to the section of the class dealing with the problem of evil. Because we've already talked about that in great detail. Even if you don't believe in concurrence, God still allows these hurricanes and earthquakes and fires to happen. He could prevent them, right? He could intervene miraculously. In other words, it's not just withdrawing his concurrence. He could step in and do something, but he doesn't in most cases. So the problem of evil, I don't think, arises simply from the doctrine of concurrence. That's going to be there for anybody who believes in an omnipotent creator. And I think Bruce is quite right to remind us what we saw then, that God has a will for this planet and for the persons on it, and that evil and suffering of all sorts is permitted only with a view toward accomplishing his good purposes for us. And with respect to moral evil, he permits this to happen but doesn't will it or intend it to happen. On the contrary, it's contrary to his will. But it is his will to have free agents who can do good or evil, and he permits them to do it. And the doctrine of concurrence would say, when they will to do evil, God concurs in producing the effects that these evil agents try to bring about, rather than withdraw his concurrence and not allowing these free agents to do their evil deeds. Yes, over here.
I prefer to be the optimist that God has made this planet to be a special place for life, because if we look at all the other planets and the storms and the hurricanes that are on Venus or on Jupiter and other places, you know, we have tragedies that happen here. I've been in several earthquakes, and I'm sure people in this room have had close brushes with tornadoes and all sorts of other disasters. But God does so many great things, and I think we can be thankful that, you know, I think in heaven, I'm optimistic about all the times that God will say, well, I intervened in your health, or I intervened in the weather, or I intervened in times that you didn't recognize it.
That is a very good point. People often say, why didn't God intervene to stop it? Well, of course, we don't know all the cases where he did intervene to stop or prevent something from happening. And so we may not realize how good we've got it. It could be much worse. So that I think, is a good reminder. Even if God were to prevent a whole lot of the evils in the world that we experience, in a world in which he did all that, people would still complain about the things that are permitted to happen that are painful. So that's a good reminder, I think. All right, any final comment here? Steve had a comment, please.
Really, I guess most of my comments I'll wait for later about the good and evil problem.
Okay.
But that's typically why, to avoid that, people coming up with that problem of evil against, it's typically referred to as God's permissive will when you're dealing with concurrence.
Yes, I take it that God's permissive will have to do with free decisions of libertarian agents. Evil decisions that people freely perpetrate. And there, God doesn't will the evil that they perpetrate. On the contrary, it's against his will, but he gives them permission to do these evil things. And then concurrence would say he concurs by producing the effects that these evil agents will. But he does so, and we'll talk about this more when we get to providence, he does so only with a view toward his providential plan for human history, in which we will see that these things were wisely allowed to happen for achieving his good purposes. Well, in our closing moments, let us turn then to the doctrine of divine providence. The biblical view of God's providence is that God has a sovereignty over the world and human affairs in the world. The doctrine of providence refers to God's governance of the world. The world is not simply a haphazardly occurring sequence of events plunging without reason this way and that. Rather, the world is under the sovereign direction of a provident God who governs the world in such a way as to achieve his purposes. Now, while the biblical passages supporting divine sovereignty over the world are too many to list, much less to read, D.A. Carson, in his book, Divine Sovereignty and Human Responsibility, published in 1981, lists these passages under four main headings. Number one are the passages indicating that God is the creator, the ruler, and the possessor of all things. Secondly, would be the passages in which God is the ultimate personal cause of all that happens. Third, would be passages dealing with God's election of his people. God sovereignly elects a people to be saved. And finally, number four would be the passages indicating that God is the unacknowledged source of good fortune or success. He's to be praised for anything that is good that happens in your life. And I think that nobody who takes these four streams of biblical teaching seriously can hold to a kind of open theism which denies God's providence over the world. The biblical concept of God's providence is a very, very strong doctrine of sovereignty, of God's control and supervision over all things. On the other hand, as Carson points out, the Hebrew way of thinking did not imagine people to be puppets or robots in God's hands. Rather, human beings are also free, moral agents. And Carson lists nine streams of tradition in the Bible that support this conclusion. Number one, people face a multitude of divine exhortations and commands. Two, people are said to obey, believe, and choose God. Thirdly, people sin and rebel against God. Fourthly, people's sins are judged by God. God holds them morally responsible for their sins and punishes them. Five, people are tested by God. Six, people receive divine rewards for their obedience. Seven, the elect are responsible to respond to God's initiative. In other words, God's election is just not unilateral, but the elect have the responsibility to respond to God's gracious initiative. Eight, prayers are not mere showpieces scripted by God. This is especially evident in the imprecatory Psalms, where the psalmist is crying out in anger to God. And nine, God literally pleads with sinners to repent and be saved. And it seems to me that these nine streams of biblical tradition would rule out a deterministic understanding of divine providence, which would exclude human freedom. A view of providence where God is simply the cause of everything that happens and human beings have no freedom whatsoever. So the question before us is, how do you put together these two seemingly incompatible but well-attested biblical truths, the sovereignty of God and the freedom of man? Well, that's what we will grapple with next time when we look at competing views of divine sovereignty.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.